This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents Junkyard Cats, written by Faith Hunter, performed by Christine Vam.
With a soft clatter, I put down the wrench and walked around my latest delivery, hands loose at my sides. I wasn't sure why I was so discomfited by the hunk of scrap. It triggered that sixth sense that had kept me alive for so long, but I couldn't tell why. Maybe I was finally being paranoid for no reason. I rubbed my sweaty scalp, my hand sliding up under my floppy hat, studying the old AGR Tesla fuselage. The hatch was sealed with the yellow tape of military and civilian decertification, tape that marked the anti-grav retrofit vehicle as airtight. It also marked it legal for scrap. Not that it was. Legal, that is. Everything looked normal, but still. I picked at the cracked orange nail polish on my fingernails, staring at the hood. Walked down one side, uncertain. My sixth sense buzzed stronger. Maybe it was the ugly paint, a piss-poor chitosan polymer job in an unexpected hot fuchsia pink that someone with lousy taste had sprayed over the former military gray. The vivid color made the space-worthy composite body look like a military camp follower in full hooker regalia. But it was just paint, nothing to make me so jittery. I walked around the fuselage and stopped at the hatch. Stepped closer, and backed away fast. That was what was bothering me. There were ants skittering over the Tesla, crawling around the hatch and up over the roof as if they had found a nice meal where the vehicle had been parked, and then seen their lunchbox carried away from their nest. They were mad, racing around the sun-heated metal as if the temp wasn't a problem at all. Ants. But not just any ants. Cataglyphus bicolor fabricius ants. Over the last few years, there had been any number of scrap deliveries that gave me the willies, and this 2035 AGR Tesla and its ants was at the top of the list. Fighting the natural desire to run, I took several more very slow steps back. The ants didn't belong here, not on this Tesla, not in the stony West Virginia desert. They didn't actually belong anywhere. The bicolors had been imported from the Sahara Desert during the first year of the war, when things had gotten bad. There had been all kinds of ecological and environmental catastrophes and stupid importations and genetic modifications that the survivors were still living with. Bicolors were among the worst environmental mistakes ever created, and they were nearly indestructible. The males, only the males, had been modified on the genetic level by bio-nanobots and sent out from some top-secret lab by the millions to clean up the mounds of dead humans and eat the germs that came from the corpses. Unable to reproduce without a female, they were programmed to die at the end of their normal lifespans. Except a few of them had absorbed some transposons from a ginkgo biloba plant, developed sequential hermaphroditism, and figured out how to reproduce. Their bites and stings had evolved overnight to become lethal. They were impossible to eradicate, and mean as hell. I know. I was swarmed and survived and had the scars to prove it. I rejected the urge to rub my right wrist on my britches. It tingled with remembered pain, burning even though the damaged nerves had been cauterized and nothing was left of the injury except the scarring and the nightmares. Unlike my other scars, these showed. And if I was making a rare trip into the big city for supplies, I either covered them with makeup or hid them beneath a sparkly bracelet to match the girly clothes and lacy gloves and dangerous strappy shoes I got to wear once in a blue moon. I still missed the girl I had been before the war. But staying alive was more important than pretty dresses. And since I was legally dead, I avoided cities and other people like the plagues they sometimes carried. I took another slow step back. I hadn't seen a bicolor in 5 years. My burger chip implant started to provide me with the usual useless data, but I tapped it off. This stuff I knew, and the only thing that mattered was that the genetically modified ants had group intelligence and killed anything that moved. Because of the modified hermaphroditism, anytime 13 male ants got together in one place without a queen, one would change sex, and voila, there was the start of a new nest. 12 bicolors and nothing happened. Add in that 13th and bingo. The bio-nanobots that had created the bicolors could be transferred only by the main queen in a nest, not any secondary females born or added to the nest. There were way more than 13 on the scrap Tesla body. All males, the short bodies and small abdomens indicating their gender. Bloody damn. I pulled back on the red knob, slowly disengaging the anti-gravity grabber. The vehicle settled gradually to the ground with a muted whomp. I adjusted my hat over my sweat-spiked hair and pulled on armored gauntlets that had been scavenged from an antique warbot, circa 2040. The bot had been part of the reason I had set up for business here, in the middle of nowhere. Smith's Junk and Scrap specialized in post-war surplus and waste. The discarded bot and the half-buried, partially intact U.S. spaceship on the back lot had been too good to pass up. The junkyard office, an even bigger lure, once I figured out what it really was, had become my home and hideaway. The Warbot gauntlets were oversized and reached my elbows, but they worked just fine, slipping 5 minuscule needles under the skin of each hand to engage my peripheral nerves. It hurt like crap for about 10 seconds, but I'd lost pain sensitivity at these particular insertion sites over the years, like calluses on my nerve endings. In the machine hut, I found a half-empty gallon jug of maltodine, a sodium-based flammable substance made for killing any number of genetically modified creatures. Back in the sun, I made sure I was downwind of the vehicle and the ants, doused the Tesla in the gooey red toxin, and watched it spread. It was created to expand and wasn't something the ants had adapted to notice as deadly. Yet. I lit and tossed an old-fashioned match at the Tesla. The fluid whooshed into flame instantly, so hot it burned blue. On fire, it spread even faster. The bicolors screamed in unison, a terrible, high-pitched harmonic that spoke of group intelligence and communal vengeance. "Burn, you little buggers," I muttered, watching as they rushed to try and save their pals and all burned, hot and spitting and gone. The flower pink paint looked cheery beneath the toxic blue flames, self-healing even as the fire danced across it. The flames were pretty in my 2-gen sunglasses as I switched back and forth between the Raptor eye lenses and UV. None of the ants made it off the Tesla's valuable graphite epoxy trusses and Hemplaz carbon fiber composite body. Not one. Relief spread through me when the last ant died. "My sensors are picking up maltodine fumes," Mateo said into my earbud. We were WIMP-powered and new-linked, the entangled dark neutrinos providing instantaneous communication, even had he been on the far side of the solar system. Mateo was my employee, sort of. I'd found the war vet working as slave labor in a town on the way here. I'd stolen him from his owner and given him a home. Mateo knew all my secrets, every single one. I tapped my ear and told him about the ants and my solution and said, "Come hell or high water, I'm making money off this purchase." Unspoken was the addendum, and a lot more money off the stolen, spanking, brand new, functional black market Tesla 23B engine my contact had put in the back hatch, along with a couple of space-going pulse weapons. Mateo and I knew scrap. And the AGR and its nowhere near legal cargo were mega valuable. Scuttlebutt said the war was heating back up. Anyone with weapons and engines stood to make a nice profit. And anyone with military supplies, weapons, and scrap needed to make sure it never fell into the wrong hands, the hands of traitors who were dealing with the enemy. I sold only to people in my network, people I trusted. And while those could be counted on one hand with fingers left over, this delivery already had buyers on both the legal market and my black market network. Mateo grunted, or as much of a grunt as his biometallic larynx could make, which was more like metal grinding and rubber squeaking. "Lunch is ready," he added. Satisfied, I took a break in the air-conditioned office and ate the lunch, a cold plate Mateo left in the double-sided fridge. He was mostly cybot now, having lost everything below the hips, part of his face, and one arm at the shoulder. He was addicted to devil milk, and I grew the plants in the camouflaged greenhouse at the back of the property just for him. It was the only thing that helped the military vet's pain. And though the government and the law said devil milk was illegal, the local law officers weren't in pain. Mateo was. So screw him. I protected my own. I didn't use. I never would, except for surgery. We outlaw militia warriors didn't use drugs of any kind. Before and after, OMW just toughed it out. Not that the militia organization even knew I was alive anymore, but some traditions were never to be neglected. I stayed clean, except for beer, and a little tequila if it was the good stuff, but not drugs, ever. Today's half-imported, half-homegrown fermented delight was a lovely extra stout, dark as sin, with a head the color of caramel and a body so thick it was like sipping a milkshake. Best beer ever made, including pre-war stuff. With the beer came gourmet hummus with hot green chilies, a green salad with tomatoes, asparagus, okra, a homemade dressing of basil vinegar mixed with olive oil and fresh bread. Just like yesterday and the day before. The veggies changing only with the growing seasons, not that I complained. Most anything was better than pre-packaged, ready-to-eat meals, and not many people got fresh food anymore. As a chef, Mateo was dependable. Not inventive. He lost that part of his brain along with the rest of his body parts. But I never turned away a military vet who wanted a meal, a gallon of fresh water, or a job. Never. It was part of the creed left to me by Pops, my father, who was OMW to the core. Leaning into the NBP compression command seat, I looked over the boards and screens that ran and oversaw the junkyard's office. I breathed the air released from the leaves of the modified air scrubber plants and watched the burning Tesla. I fanned myself with my damp floppy hat and let the AC cool me, drying my sweat to a crusty, salty layer of white. I ate, drank the beer and a lot of water, took several electrolyte tablets and watched through the heavy weapon fire resistant window as the maltodine burned across the exterior of the ancient AGR Tesla. I could separate, recycle, and sell the body. The hemp tires were dry-rotted. The interior of the cockpit, what I had seen through the silk plaz canopy, was bare to the frame. The space where the MBP compression seats were gone. Electrical and hydro were gone. The wings had been stripped off and secured to a separate skid with military flex for easier transport. The rear engine compartment was sealed and invisible from the outside, but the weight alone told me that the Tesla 23B massive particle propulsion engine I had paid extra for, a lot extra for, had been tucked into the hatch along with the weapons, just as I had been promised. So that meant my jitters were solely from the ants, my own personal nightmare come calling. Pops had said, "Fear is a peculiar thing, love. You either run toward it, away from it, or you freeze." Yeah, I had frozen, and that was stupid in the middle of a battle. I was always in the middle of a battle, even if it was just the one in my head. Half an hour later, the fire was out. I used the composting toilet, brushed my teeth, put on more 110 SPF sunscreen, and smeared on moisturizing lip gloss in a deep orange color. Just because it was practical didn't mean it couldn't be pretty, even in the treeless, rocky West Virginia desert landscape where no one could see me. I headed back to the Tesla. It was steaming in the day's heat as the last of the toxic fumes blew away. The mounting jacks used for the pulse weapons, the anti-grav, and the WIMP engine were now superheated hot pink metal, as were the strip weapons mounts. Using the wrench I had put aside earlier, I popped the lock, and the hatch over the rear engine compartment began to lift, ripping through the fireproof yellow tape that marked it as sealed by various West Virginia authorities. The black maw opened. The stench boiled out. The engine and the weapons I'd been expecting had not been sealed inside after all. The body in their place smiled at me, so to speak. He'd been dead a while. Most of the tissue of his lips, nose, and lids were gone, revealing tobacco-stained teeth and empty holes where his eyes had been. He was naked and mostly covered by hundreds of bicolors. I froze in place, not breathing, my heart beating so hard it felt as if it would pound through my chest. The little scavenger predator ants would have sensed their compatriots dying, but that had been eons ago in bicolor time. They paused, evaluated the opening of the hatch and my unmoving body, which was cooler than the ambient temp, decided there were no predators, and went back to work, rushing all over the inside of the Tesla and all over the naked body. Except three spots. Two were where his tats had been inked above his heart. On his upper pec were two black six-shooters crossed over a gold star that still glittered with the ink the OMW had begun utilizing just after the war started in 2043. Tattered pride gold, made only for the outlaw militia warriors. The letters OMW were red and dripped down like blood onto the lower, larger tat. Touched by the last drop of red ink, was an original outlaw tat, skull and crossed Harley pistons, also free of ants. The tats were old and faded, and so was he. A war vet and an OMW-made man, mid-60s, silvered red hair and beard, and a tattoo of Tennille Tennyson's face on his left bicep. Ants were eating away at the tat of the singer's pretty face. I knew this guy. Just by his tattoos, even without running a viber over him for verification. His name was Harlan, Buck Harlan. He was my connection to the network, the black market web where I bought and sold weapons and info. He and Mateo were the only people in the entire world who knew I was alive. He had been my father's friend. He was also my friend, one of only two. Something inside me broke, shattered into slivers like glass, cutting my soul. I managed a breath I had been holding too long. The ants didn't notice the slight movement. The third part of Harlan that hadn't been attacked by bicolors was the hemp plaz note in his swollen fingers. On the front were my initials in his messy scrawl. The chances of Harlan showing up here, in the middle of nowhere, by accident, covered in bicolors, with a note to me in his dead fingers, were low enough to be impossible. Harlan was dead because of me, which meant there was a traitor in the gov, and in Harlan's network. I just didn't know who. I swore, but silently, in my head, not where the ants could hear me. They still hadn't noticed me, yet. I stepped back, slowly, slowly, moving steadily, doing nothing quick to attract attention. I pulled my handheld and took a burst of the body. Walking at a snail's pace around the vehicle, I took multiple bursts of stills as I moved, until I was back at the hatch. Moving so slow it was like watching the sun cross the sky, I slipped on the military bot gloves. But something alerted the bicolors. As the gloves gripped onto my hands and arms, the ants turned to look at me. All of them. All at once. A shiver took me, even without the heat. But I didn't scream, run, or indicate fear that might tweak their predatory instincts. Moving millimeter by millimeter, I pocketed the handheld and reached for the maltodine. I needed to kill them. I needed to read that letter. The ants hissed, all of them together, a single sharp, piercing note, looking right at me. "Oh, bloody damn," I whispered. The ants raced around, forming into small groups, each the requisite 39 in number, which was three groups of 13. There were four groups of 39 in all, with a ragged half group, enough to start over a dozen new nests. Here, on my junkyard land, over my dead body, over Harlan's dead body. Assuming they were a swarming party, sent to bring back food to an established nest, that meant these bicolors had been transported a good 100 kilometers from their queen. It tended to take a few hours before the ants noticed that they didn't have a female anymore. It took 72 hours to complete the transition to female. I didn't know how long they had been away from their nest, but they would notice they needed to create a queen soon. I had to act now, but I needed that note. "Shining, company," Mateo's synthetic voice said directly into my wireless earbud. "Bike, unknown model. Dank leaks out. I am launching Arvex," he said, referring to auto-remote viewing aircraft, flying drones with better than standard artificial intelligence and real-time viewing, part of the junkyard's defense system. "The law," I whispered, looking at Harlan's body, the jug a hand breadth from my fingertips. I had no desire to be hauled in for questioning over a dead man I hadn't seen in years. But I had no desire to have ants take over my junkyard. I had no desire to be swarmed again. Remembered fear shivered down my spine like thousands of tiny ant feet. "Unproven," he said. "One vehicle. Approaching at 54 kilometers per hour. No visible backup." No sane lawman rode anywhere alone, and never on a bike. Someone had sent Harlan's body, part of a special delivery sealed by the gov. With bloody bicolor ants, which no sane person would have done, it could not be simple bad luck. Not the law, not the gov, not the military. The gift giver was someone who wanted to play with me like a pride of cats with a junkyard dog, or someone who knew what I really had on the property. I opened the maltodine and tossed the entire container in the hatch. The ants swarmed toward me. I struck a match, reached for the hatch door with one gloved hand, tossed the match with the other. Lightning fast, I ripped the note away just before the hatch closed. Intense heat boiled out, and I heard the ants scream as the sound cut off. Maltodine burned anything anywhere, even without oxygen, except hemplaz composite. Maltodine didn't burn anything made of metal or hemp that had been combined with silkplaz at the atomic level. It burned until it no longer had anything organic to fuel it. Harlan, however, was organic. I tapped over my heart with a two-fingered salute and said, "Peace, my brother. There will be no more war. May your last ride on the dragon's tail be peaceful." I dropped my salute. "Deets on the visitor when available," I requested of Mateo. "And calculate maltodine burn time of 100 kilos of organic matter in an anaerobic environment." Copy that. The burger chip implant started to provide the answer. I shut it down. Once I let that thing start talking, it never shut up. And I had to sleep sometime. With a gauntleted fist, I hammered the red ignition button, and the AG grabber came back on, the almost imperceptible whine and itch under my skin. Initiating the controls, I maneuvered the grabber over the top of the Tesla and lowered the unit until it almost connected. Then I raised the old war fuselage, 3.5 meters off the ground, the maximum ever achieved on land, even by the military of 3 warring groups of allied nations. Anti-grav was a misnomer on a planet's surface, the moniker applied by a PR person when it was first invented, and it had stuck, even after WIMP engines had given us intrasolar system flight that did way more than levitate stuff. I headed to the office, through the airlocks back into the cool, where I flipped open the note. It simply said, SS, I hope I make it to you alive, but that ain't looking likely. I was ambushed, shot, made it to the Tesla and crawled through into the hatch. Name of the shooter was One-Eyed Jack. They know about you. They're coming. BH. SS was me, Shining Smith. BH was Buck Harlan. They were the people who had killed him and were coming for me. Could have used a little more info in your note, Buck. But I'm sorry you died delivering it. Tears evaporated so fast I hardly noticed them gather. I opened the small hatch of the armor niche and stepped up on the mounting pedestal. I was about to turn my back to the armor suit and initiate auto-donning when it occurred to me that appearing in military armor and weaponed up was acting out of fear and giving away my hand. It was one person heading in, not an army. Maybe I was wrong that this person was coming for me. Maybe Harlan was wrong. Maybe my life as I knew it was over. If whoever sent Harlan to me, dead and all, had just wanted to kill me, I'd already be dead. If the military had figured out who I was, and half of what Smith's junk and scrap really was, my small part of the Earth would have been inundated with uniformed warriors. If the Gov itself had found me and knew what I was, the bureaucracy would have been more direct. A missile barrage would have arced over the junkyard and taken out everything, leaving nothing but a hole in the rock. End of Shining Smith. So, I didn't need to wade in fighting, yet. Fear receded now that I was thinking and not just reacting. This wasn't done by any usual suspect who wanted me dead. No. Someone was sending me a message and a threat. Someone wanted something I was or something I had. I thought about the crashed spaceship debris half buried out back, hidden beneath the best ghillie tech camo cloth ever devised. But no one knew about it, except for Mateo, and only Mateo knew the full nature of my defenses. So, they must be after the conventional weapons I had stockpiled for the eventual resurgence of the war. I wasn't giving up my weapons, my money, or my ship. I especially wasn't giving up the weapons to traitors, and I sure as hell wasn't giving up my office. I needed to go in with a presumptive position of weakness and lie through my teeth, assuming that just because a motorcycle was heading this way, it was not my past nightmares come calling. It might not be. It could be a coincidence. I cursed and stepped away from the niche, into the personal toilet compartment, which would have been a bathroom if we had sufficient fresh water, and checked the lipstick, combed my hair, which was still wet and spiked with sweat, smeared on Kajal, Desert Dweller's heavy eyeliner. Lips and lids were all the makeup the heat could stand. Anything more would melt off my face. I pulled the desert camo tank top and military cargo pants off my body and hung them to dry, ran the body wand over my pits and privates, spritzed on something to counteract my natural stink. Some women smelled of lilacs and roses. I'd been brought up a warrior. I dismantled vehicles and ran a black market weapons business at a junkyard. To smell better would deny what I really was. And also, I just hated the stink of perfumes. I sprayed an extra layer of sunscreen over my very bronzed skin, because you can never have too much sunscreen. Not since the WIMP explosion over Germany tore through the plant's electromagnetic shield and ripped all the good stuff out of the atmosphere. Location of bike? I asked Matteo.
6 clicks out, RVAC cameras reveal male body shape. Full face helmet and gold clothes, all in white and desert camouflage patterns. Bike is matte black.
His recon briefing paused.
Correction. Visual shielding has been activated. Bike is now desert patterns. Activating silent tracking.
Silent tracking was something left to me by my father. At the time, it was the very latest in military R&D, a way to track most anything that created a visual, audible, or thermal trail, even through the military's own shielding. Pops wasn't supposed to have that kind of tech, and I had no idea how he got it. I had no idea how he got any of the stuff I'd found here. The silent tracking had been stored in a kiosk in the middle of the junkyard when I returned, half dead and with a stolen, deranged warbot in tow. Then I had discovered the other devices, the weapon systems, the anti-gravity grabber, a stockpile of illegal weapons to which I had added significantly. The USSS, Sunstar. A spaceship built by the Western Alliance, led by the U.S., had crash-landed at some point prior to my arrival. And then there was the office. The main reason I remained here, in a junkyard Pops had kept off the books, was the office. And then the meaning of what Matteo had said hit home. Visual shielding on the bike meant military connections or a wannabe soldier. Either way, it meant trouble. Calculations of burn time in the Tesla? I asked Matteo.
2 hours and 16 minutes to clean bone. 4 hours additional, give or take, to full ash.
Cremation would have taken about 1 hour. Maltodine was just as effective, but it took longer. 6.5 hours. The sun would be down by then and the solar panels offline. I didn't have the battery power to run the grabber into the night. I'd have to set the Tesla down soon and let it burn on the ground. But not while I had company.
Speed of approaching vehicle is increasing. Suspect our RVACs have been made.
Fine. Bring them home and dock them. You geared up?
Little girl. I am always geared up.
Which was true. Matteo was semi-permanently attached to his bot. If he left it, he was disconnected. He'd be dead inside a week. And he'd die badly. I'd seen him out of the suit when I placed him into the med bay the week we met. It hadn't been a pretty sight. At the closet, I ignored the dresses, which would not fit with the persona I was envisioning, and pulled on a bright pink tank, the color I chose surely inspired by the hot pink of the AGR's paint job. The color made me look sweet and defenseless. Not like me at all. The tank and the matching cargo pants had belonged to little mama. My mother. They still smelled like her. And though it had been years since she died, tears threatened. Little mama had looked cute when she rode bitch seat on Pop's bike. But she had manned the guns for him when the war started and had gone down fighting when the soldiers of the People's Republic of China's Central Military Commission landed in Port Angeles, Washington with the first warbots. The outlaws had been mid-rally when the PRC warbots walked ashore, and the motorcycle club had defended the public until the nearby cities had been evacuated. That was the start of World War III. And the end of the world as I had known it. I was Helen gone from the war, I reminded myself. Helen gone. But my nerves buzzed with adrenaline and fear as I slid a sweat-wicking, UV-protected sheer dupatta over my tank. It wasn't cold clothes, but the dupatta fit the persona I was adopting. A civilian, a transplanted city girl who still looked to fashion. dark tanned from sun exposure under the thinned atmosphere. Weird eyes hidden under the two gens, a stray lighter streak in my short spiked hair from too much sun exposure. The grease under my nails and the chipped polish told the truth about me, and I probably should have repainted them. Not that there was time. No female ever went unarmed in the wild, so guns were okay even with the outfit. Under the dupatta, I slung a harness around my shoulders and hips and tightened it on my waist. Considered pulse weapons, but a scrapyard employee would more likely have explosive-based weaponry, not high-end military stuff. I checked the 3 9mm weapons the harness was built to hold, reconsidered, and clicked just one into place in its hemp plaz holster, added extra mags into the pockets. Basic minimal wear for a female employee in the wilds, like I was now pretending to be. I pulled on a pair of gloves to protect my fake persona and to protect the visitor from me just in case he got close enough to touch. Arvec data reveals the bike is a new variation of the OMW-1 Rider, Mateo said. My hands froze. I stopped moving entirely. Silent tracking scans reveal that One Rider has been militarized with after-stock equipment and weapons. Listing, 1 9mm Heckler & Koch MP8 UMP. 2 9mm Heckler & Koch MP8 machine pistols. 2 semi-automatic weapons on his person, make unknown. Though it's currently offline, the bike is equipped with a camouflaged, miniaturized pulse weapon. Bloody hell. He was equipped to start a small war, and half the bike stuff made no sense. Miniaturized pulse weapons were practically unknown outside of the military, and it was just weird on a Harley. The burning Tesla had been retrofitted with pulse weapons based on dark matter for battles in space, but no one, even outlaw militia warriors, had access to it in peacetime. Unless the bike had been part of a government contract. OMW always had government contracts. Bugger, I cursed. The Harley has defensive shields available but not activated, Mateo said. Bike's visual shielding is good, maybe as good as mine. He hesitated. Maybe better. Mateo's military bot shielding was the very latest design from the end of the war. No one should have defensive or visual shielding as good as his. All the details meant that the dude riding up to my place of business and arriving just after Harlan's untimely demise and appearance wasn't a fluke or coincidence. Whoever the traitors to the war effort were, they had found me. Unless I'd been found by more than one group or person, because worst-case scenarios were just my dumb luck. If so, then one group had killed Harlan. Another had sent a rep carrying a universal machine pistol and the latest in OMW weapons. Within minutes of each other? A different kind of message? Or the OMW responding to the first message? Bloody damn. I could kill the rider. I could toss him in with Harlan, whose body was currently powering the maltodine burn. But my newest visitor was surely tracked and others would come. In his wonderful British accent, Pops had once said to the OMWs, "The world is changing, lads. We have to adapt. We have to evolve. To remain static is death." "Pops," I had said from the front row where I was watching his speech. "Even corpses change." I knew. I'd seen enough of them. Some of the warriors had laughed. Pops hadn't. And then little Mama had died. And I had been swarmed by bicolors. And we had done the unthinkable. A lot of unthinkables. And Pops had started dying. Slow bit by slow bit as the Parkinson's ate his body and his brain. I had tried, but been unable to save him. Nothing had saved him. I slammed my feet into cute, heeled boots and ran a finger up the seal, crammed a clean hat with a wide brim and a faded silk rose on my head. I snatched a nail file out of the flower pot that had once held Little Mama's orchids, wiped two insulated bottle keepers, and plucked two iced drinks out of the fridge, wiping them as I raced out of the office through the first and then the second airlock doors. Sealing both airlock doors on the cold air inside, I walked out to meet the rider. The heat hit me like a wrecking ball, and fresh sweat broke out all over. "Activating perimeter defenses," Mateo said. "You never deactivate them," I said. "True," he said. "But they rode along our front border, and the drives stay at DEFCON 4 unless we expect trouble. Now we're at DEFCON 3. "Why DEFCON 3? "Because something smells." Since Mateo no longer had a real nose, I knew he meant figuratively. "You aren't armored up," he stated. "I'm going for Little Mama's defensive tactics," I said, setting the icy bottles in their holders in the shade. Not that the shade offered much protection from the summer heat. "Ah, poor guy." It wasn't easy to tell, but Mateo sounded almost happy about the coming carnage. "ETA, 60 seconds. I knew that by the sound of the bike. There were muters on the engine, the soft snore familiar for a wartime one-rider Harley in infiltrator mode. I missed the full-throated war bike roar, the wind in my hair, the road thrumming through my body. I missed that freedom. I pulled a chair into the shade of the AG grabber. The seat was padded and so hot from the scalding sun that it burned my butt through the cloth of Mama's pink pants. But there wasn't time to cool the seat or baby my butt. I slid the converted, inverted shooting table in front of me and I propped my booted feet on it. Unlatching the thumb lock on the table, I made sure it would invert in its usual half second if I dropped my feet, exposing the pre-war M249 Paragen II belt-fed machine gun, currently mounted on the table's other side. The weapon was hidden by the heavy-duty, honeycombed composite sheeting that was actually a pretty good shield for most small arms fire. I had repurposed it from mid-grade quality space scrap. If an enemy assassin riding a bike had found me, there wouldn't be enough left of him or his bike to send home in a box. The burn inside the Tesla had superheated the desert hot as the entrance to hell air. Sweat was trickling down my spine. If the OMW had found me, I didn't know what would happen. I was supposed to be dead. If two groups had found me, I was well and truly screwed. The muted engine noise grew closer and changed trajectory as it slowed and turned down the drive. "Company's here," Mateo said. "All systems go." Sweat slid between my boobs and soaked into my clothes across my back and belly. The sun beat down around me like nuclear fallout. 45 degrees C in the shade. Water boiled at 100. So I was halfway to scalded. I popped the top of one drink and took a long pull, set it aside, pulled off one glove, and flipped the nail file up. I was as ready as I was going to get. The bike went silent. I gave it a good 5-second pause before I called out, "I've got a cold drink with your name on it if you come with cash to buy." 5 more seconds went by. As the rider either got into a better position to kill me or tried to decide how to proceed. Mateo didn't update me, so I was betting my death wasn't intended. Yet. Another 5 seconds went by. And another. I caught a slight reflection as Mateo moved into place between the entrance and me. His 7.5 meter tall warbot suit in full visual shielding, his head invisible behind a meter of horizontal silk plaz viewscreen. Mateo muttered, "Body posture is too ready." I relaxed just a bit, filed a rough spot off my trigger fingernail. The black engine grease around my cuticle was a dead giveaway that I wasn't the girly girl the clothes suggested. If I let the stranger get close enough to see that grime, I better already know he wasn't a threat. I really needed to give myself a full mani. From the corner of my eye, I caught a flash of movement. A big, solid gray cat was crouched on the roof of the office, one of the two breeding males of the prides of junkyard cats. His fighting partner, a black-haired, green-eyed male devil, raced along a branched pre-war electrical pole, leaning against an old earth mover. Dang cats had heard the sound of the bike and come to investigate. I tried to remember the last time I had provided the junkyard cats a ritual offering, dead goat or cave bat, and nothing came to mind. The most I'd had to share lately was my water and some goat milk. Nothing high in protein. I hoped they'd behave, but they were cats, so it wasn't likely. "He's changing gear, steel armed," Mateo murmured into my earbud. "Lighting a cigar." That was a good sign. I couldn't see an assassin taking time to start a smoke. The two male cats inched closer to the edges of their perches. As one, the hunting females raised heads and looked over the open space I currently occupied, then back to the entrance before hiding again. I had no idea what they were looking at, but the prides were synchronized enough to be scary. It reminded me of the bicolors and their modifications, reminded me again that I made mistakes over the years. Big ones. My visitor walked around the corner, 2 meters tall, with a strong neck and broad, sloping shoulders, a chest like a brick shithouse, narrow waist, and huge hands, each finger wearing a ring, like disconnected knucks. Fast-looking and rangy, if rangy was also big enough to play offensive tackle in the NFL. Bugger was big. Sweaty brown hair was cut 2 centimeters long and lay flat to his skull, his beard a half centimeter of buzz. Brown skin, maybe Hispanic, maybe American tribal, maybe mixed, cock, and surprise special like me. Little Mama hadn't known her ethnic heritage and Pops hadn't cared. My visitor's brown eyes were hard and focused on me. He was neither happy nor unhappy. A smart, violent man with a job he liked and was scary good at. He must have left the protective gear on the bike because he wore battle boots, no cold coat or pants, no sunglasses or helmet, just brownish Harley Davidson riding plecs and a loose, long-sleeved t-shirt in desert camo. Over his shirt, he wore an OMW kutta, the official riding vest of the outlaws. And though I had mostly expected it, my body went into battle stillness. The leather vest was worn and raw in places and was fully covered with chapter patches from a whole bunch of the pre-war states. More significant were the patches from post-war foreign countries. He had traveled the world for the outlaws even after the peace treaty. This asshole was a very important dude in the OMW. He had been called to serve everywhere. Maybe most important, he had a patch from the mother chapter in old Chicago. Criminy. Whoever he was more than a full patch member, more than just a made man. His patches showed he had moved up in the world from a nobody to a national sergeant at arms, also known as an enforcer, which meant he reported to the vice president of the entire club. The club motto patch, "God forgives, outlaws don't, adios," was worn and maybe blood splattered. In this day when any drop of blood could instantly ID the donor, that was brave, or scary stupid, or proud of the death of his enemies. I went with door number 3. There was a dark bulge at his belt, a handgun, butt exposed, a big mother semi-automatic. The grip was marked with a scarlet skull and crossbones. The biometric marker indicated it was linked to him alone, an expensive high-tech killer's gun. Assassins used them when they wanted to make a statement.
Bugger,
I muttered aloud to Mateo.
Not interested, the visitor said with an easy smile.
He stopped in the shade of the office, his head nearly touching the overhang and directly under the gray cat. He stood hip-shot and puffed on the cigar. The smell of the smoke and the sight of the kuta reminded me of Pops, and I narrowed my eyes against tears. I couldn't afford an emotional reaction now. I sipped, waiting for the moisture to dry out in the heat. He puffed several times, clenched the cigar in his teeth, smoke curling up but missing his eyes.
You say you got a cold one?
His voice was low and gravelly, and his mouth did interesting things around the cigar. If I needed to goad him, I could. He looked like the kind of man who'd be irritated at being accused of getting friendly with another man, and his reaction to the word bugger confirmed it. If you're here to waste my time, no. If you're a paying customer, cash only. I got beer, stout. I flashed a now smooth fingernail at the beers. Bottle's been out in the cold for 2 minutes, but in a holder in the shade, it's still drinkable. I didn't hold up the bottle, but I did place a finger on the flip table's release button. He didn't move.
I might be buying. You the boss?
It's his day off. I'm Smith's junk and scraps receptionist and accountant. I can make any deal he can make. Maybe better.
Why better?
Because I know what bills are due tomorrow. He never looks and wouldn't care if he did. The two fighter cats turned in unison and stared at me, right where my finger was perched on the release button. That meant there was a female directly behind me, watching and transmitting the info to all the other cats. The cats had mad mental skills, and they communicated by scent or body language or frickin' ESP for all I knew. My neck crawled with near panic. I didn't like a hungry pride cat behind me. I'd seen them scavenge for protein. It was not pretty. The outlaw puffed. Smoke blew out and dissipated. The silence went on too long, as if this was a test. The hairs on my nape lifted despite the sweat, and I felt almost cold. Nerves scuttled along my skin like bicolor ants, and my wrist burned, wanting to be used. But he was too far away, thankfully. My heart rate sped, and I blew it. You got a handle I can use? Or is Enforcer good enough? The man went still as a bot. Bloody damn. I just proved I knew what he was. I lied fast, part truth, part fabrication. My mama used to date an outlaw. He got his teeth knocked out by an enforcer. He deserved it. I never forgot the patch. The man waited, considering, sucked on the cigar. Smoke curled. It was harsh, stronger than the burned maltodine stink.
What'd he do?
He asked at last.
The man your mama dated.
He was using cocaine. He beat mama. He tried to beat me. I hid. Then the enforcer came. We never had that problem again.
His handle?
Darson. Or as I called him and all bikers since, asshole. He considered, his eyes tightening, as he pulled the name up from a memory burger chip. Darson had been given an attitude adjustment when I was 10 or 11. I'd witnessed it. It had been bloody, but the report said he went through voluntary withdrawal, never used again, and he stopped beating up his old lady and her daughter. They had all been killed in Seattle at the first of the war, right after the Chinese landed. Or, like a lot of records, their reported deaths might have been wrong. I'm Jaeger. Good name for a pit bull. Gold gets you the best pricing, but cash is good too. What are you buying? He didn't react to being called a dog. I got cash. Which said nothing about whether or what he was buying, but my persona would have accepted that. You want that beer while it's cold? You can come over. What's on the other side of that table? He asked instead. I glanced down at my lap. I'd have expected a better come-on from a pit bull named Jaeger. He smiled, I smiled. He went for the handgun. I flipped the table, ducked, and aimed. He was fast, but he was human, and I wasn't where I'd been. He was looking down the barrel of the M249 Paragen II belt-fed machine gun. The gun's retrofit auto sights and wartime firing mechanism were trained on him. I had a good 46 centimeters of ammo ready to go. Meanwhile, I was now protected by a flap of material constructed from part of a space-capable warship. I was effectively shielded from anything he might be carrying. Lucky that, because he was holding a .40 caliber H&K, a mid-war weapon created for close-in work against the Russian bloc in Eastern Europe. I'd been right. A blow-em-to-hell-and-back, down-and-dirty, leave-a-message-splattered-on-the-walls weapon. Nice. He said. Outlaws might use pulse weapons in wartime, but they were all gun nuts at heart. And the Paragen was a made man's fantasy gun. The motion, revealing the haft of a knife in a hip sheath, he put away the down and dirty gun. I didn't put away the Paragen. He walked over, watching as the barrel followed him. He chuckled as if having an auto-targeting system and enough ammo to rip apart an elephant was amusing. He stopped in front of the barrel, and it was pointed at his solar plexus. I returned to my chair, feet up like before, shoved the extra beer across to him with my boot. It slid with a smooth sound, leaving behind a trail of water. The stouts had been on a separate table leaf and hadn't flown into the desert air. I'd never waste good beer. I drank down half of mine. He looked over my weapons as he popped the top and drank his, stopped, lowered the bottle, studied me. His eyes changed. The lie had been perfect, but that was when I knew I'd screwed up. I just didn't know how bad. He blew a smoke ring. I didn't care much for most tobacco, but good quality cigars were an exception. The smoke and the scent fit him. Something like longing filled me. Longing was dangerous. My wrist itched. I narrowed my eyes at him, not that he could tell much behind my orange lenses. He tapped ash, talked around the cigar. I'm looking for a cutter. Holy hell. Oh? Special cutter. Been missing a while. Tracking sensor was activated a week ago. I had admitted to knowing about outlaw militia warriors, so I couldn't say I didn't know what he was talking about. Pop's OMW cutter was in the vault, vacuum sealed. I hadn't touched it. No one had. Not even air had touched it. No way it had been activated. If Harlan had been decomposing in his kutta, it was a goner and I was screwed. OMWs didn't burn kuttas except at a proper ceremony. However, Pop's kutta wasn't the only one on site. I set my mouth as if I was thinking through inventory. I figured it out fast. My kutta was hanging in my wardrobe. It had a few ancient wartime sensors implanted in the patches, warnings about fumes from gas attacks, a radiation sensor, that sort of thing. All of them had gone offline years ago as the batteries finally died. But there was one particular sensor, one I hadn't thought about in years. that had been put together by Pops just before he passed. After I'd been swarmed by bicolors, and after I'd had my run-in with a mama bot. But before I'd had to run. If its battery had survived the war and the years. I blinked behind my sunglasses and took a slow breath of dry desert air. Triggered a week ago? What triggers it? I asked, as fear began to glide across my shoulders and down my spine. Because I already knew. PRC warriors, or bots, Jaeger said casually. Too casually.